It's long since been a cliche in our society that things change, and they change unpredictably, although most people don't seem to have caught up with the actual concept. I always hear prophets of doom saying, all is lost, and they think that they're being practical, whereas someone who says all is won is being Pollyanna and being impractical. But the fact is, if you're going to be a prophet of doom, you're a prophet to start with. You're just as much a prophet as someone who says everything's going to be fine, or someone who tries to predict the next president or the next anything. A prophet is something none of us are. That's why the word progressive that liberals now use instead of liberal, since they have made the word liberal a bad word, actually trying liberal policies has made the word liberal into a laughing stock. So they call themselves progressives now. Now the problem with the word progressive is that a progressive is a prophet. A progressive is someone who is, by definition, moving towards the future. That means that in order to be a progressive, you must know what the future is. That means that you are claiming to be a prophet. So the word progressive is even sillier than the word liberal, but of course no respectable conservative is going to mention that. So we live in a world where we should have grown out of the idea that we can be prophets of doom or prophets of anything, because things change so completely. But there's one thing that is unique to our age, one area in which change takes place every day, and it's the one area where we always thought things were fixed, and that is history is changing daily. Since the development of carbon dating, our history has changed radically. There was the idea that everything was invented in the Middle East, and so when they found Stonehenge, they assumed that way up there in Britain, Stonehenge was the last of the great monuments built by that particular civilization that we're discovering more and more of, the one that put all those stones in northern France. There are things like Stonehenge stretching all the way down from Britain down into the Mediterranean, and they assumed that the ones in the Mediterranean came first because everything was in the Middle East first. Then they started carbon dating the wood that they found around those sites and found out that actually Stonehenge, the original Stonehenge, which was wooden, was one of the first and the very last were down there by the Middle East, where all things are supposed to have come from. Well, that's sort of reversed history. And this whole business of carbon dating is just the tip of the iceberg. They found those mummies, those northern European mummies, blonde ones, in China. They find many things that they can date, but dating, carbon dating, critical as it is just one of many discoveries. One of the great discoveries was the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Dead Sea Scrolls, for example, would have been unreadable before the space program. They used space program technology to restore the Dead Sea Scrolls. Otherwise, they would have been ruined beyond use. But they managed to use a light technique that was developed by the space program, and sure enough, 2,000-year-old history was changed by the Dead Sea Scrolls. And these discoveries are coming in. DNA is changing our view. We are finding just how kin, for example, the dinosaur, was to today's chicken or today's bird. The fact that history itself is changing is a lot like being in an earthquake. For some reason, disasters follow me around like a puppy dog. So I've been in tornadoes, and hurricanes, and earthquake. And while none of these make you feel particularly comfortable, those of you who have been in an earthquake know that there's something very special about an earthquake. The one thing you could always count on, even when a tidal wave was coming your way, or a storm, or a tornado, was its relationship, the relationship of the wind or the water, to the ground. The ground was fixed. An earthquake is very hard on an animal that's evolved on this planet for several million years and always considered the ground to be the one thing he could count on. When the ground begins to give way, it gives rise to an internal panic that I think is different from any other kind. The same thing is true of history. Every time we talk about looking to the future or predicting something, we always look back to the solid ground of the past, and on that basis, we have some idea of the future. But what is really disturbing at this point is that history itself is changing radically pretty well every year. When New Orleans went underwater, Bill O'Reilly and the liberals he has to get to approve of him were shouting that the problem in New Orleans was really caused by the kind of greedy people who drive SUVs, gas guzzlers that pollute the atmosphere. What they start with is the assumption that the earth is pretty steady, that is, the climate, and you don't get things like New Orleans. You didn't get them in history, so it must be our fault if New Orleans went underwater. Well, it hasn't been that long since we found out where the Black Sea came from. Now, the Black Sea sits behind Istanbul, used to be Constantinople, but before that it was Byzantium. And the Black Sea is the size of several countries. It is gigantic. It is also recent. What happened was, about 12,000 years ago, that whole area that is now the Black Sea was a low-lying area, presumably well-populated, also fertile, also warm because it was so low, and it was protected by some miles of land where Byzantium, or Istanbul, now sits. Istanbul is up at sea level, but the area which is now the Black Sea was far below sea level and was protected by the land that connected Asia and Europe. It was way below sea level, a good deal further below sea level than New Orleans was, but New Orleans was below sea level. And the barrier between that area and the Mediterranean Sea was washing away. Suddenly one day, and apparently it was within a matter of days, the whole thing broke like a huge dam, and a tidal wave came rushing in about 300 feet high. That is, some people think that's where the idea of Noah's flood, which was in Gilgamesh and all the old stories in the Middle East, where that Noah's flood came from. Now, we don't know how far that first big wave went. It may have covered this whole tens of thousands of square miles of area at one time, but it was certainly a major disaster at the time. And in 10,000 BC, very, very few people were driving SUVs. A Kyoto Treaty would not have prevented this, and this was a hell of a lot bigger area than New Orleans. So it's a little naive to think that the world is pretty stable place except for us. Things like New Orleans are going to happen. If you're below sea level, there's an excellent chance that you're going to be deluged when the ocean gets through. But, once again, these people live in a world of the history of, say, 1950, whereas we are learning every day huge strides are made in history and our past is changing. This is a serious problem for people who build theories, which social scientists are paid to do. Every theory that comes out of the universities is based on a particular view of the past, which is then projected to the future. We don't have any other way of doing this. until 1950, or actually into the 1970s, it was assumed, for example, that man was the only animal that had borders. It was considered one of the silly things about mankind that they would put up border guards and have wars with each other, whereas all the animals, all chimpanzees were chimpanzees, all apes were apes, that there was no class system among animals, there was no nationality between animals, they had no borders. The reason that a bird chirped, for example, was to attract a mate. And it hasn't been 15 years since it was discovered that chimpanzees patrol their borders in what we would call radio silence. They're very silent. And if another chimpanzee comes across their border, they tear that chimpanzee to pieces. They chase them down. Before that, I'm talking about 1990, it was assumed that chimpanzees were sweet little vegetarian animals. Now, if you take this back to Rousseau and Karl Marx, they always assumed that man was the only animal that had borders, the only animal that had a class system. Actually, the animal class system is a good deal, in most cases, a good deal more rigid than ours. And when I say ours, I mean in white countries, the class system is not as rigid as, say, it has historically been in other societies. We didn't have kings until the Middle Eastern ideas penetrated with Christianity. We had representative democracy. They like to say that Iceland was the first representative democracy because they set up a parliament when Iceland was first founded around 1000 AD. Actually, what they did was do what they've always done. They had a representative. They had representative governments in Northern Europe long before that. In fact, many of the people who settled Iceland were running away from the Christian king of Norway. But again, this is not the sort of thing we knew when I was coming up. The class system in animal societies is as rigid as the traditional class system in China or in the Middle East. Once you get to be the alpha male, somebody has to knock you off that perch. And the lower classes are the lower classes, and they stay the lower classes. It's amazing how recently we discovered this. So history is changing as fast as our vision of the future, which makes the person who thinks he's a prophet of doom or who says he is a progressive even sillier. We know and have known for a long time that the future was totally unpredictable because of these unexpected changes pouring in. Now we find that the past is unpredictable because of these enormous changes coming in. So if before someone who called himself a progressive or someone who was a prophet of doom, if they were stupid before, they're stupid squared now. In 1970, we had no idea that the computer revolution that I'm using right now would be anything like what it is now, personal computers, the web. But we also had no idea that chimpanzees were not peaceful animals. We had no idea that Northern Europeans were in China. In fact, the clothes that those Northern Europeans were wearing, the mummies, 4,000-year-old mummies, those clothes were of a weave, a type of weave, that all historians agreed had been developed in the, guess what, Middle East, about the time of Christ. The reason for that was that was when the Middle East obtained this weave. They didn't have it before. And since everything started in the Middle East, it was assumed that was the first. And this whole business of that was the first completely warps our whole view of history. We always have this specific idea of that was the first. The Middle East was the first, or the latest type of man's ancestors that we find was the very first. Science News is a very interesting little publication of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. I say little because it's only 20, something like 15 or 20 thin pages that hit the highlights. It's not because it's a small publication. It's, in fact, I think it's something like a million circulation or hundreds of thousands anyway. So it's a very big publication. It's just a little publication in actual size. And I put a little piece in there about 25 years ago that seems so obvious now that you would wonder whether such a thing was necessary. But around 1980, there was a spate of discoveries of early man. And every time somebody dug up something in Africa and found some sort of Australopithecus or some earlier type of man, the headlines would read, "Earliest man found." They did not say earliest man so far, and this irritated me because each time this discovery was made, the publications would start revamping theories around this particular discovery, and I knew, as well as I knew that it would rain someday, that within a couple of months, somebody else would unearth another older fossil of a human being, and everybody would scurry around to comment on that. All I wrote in the article was, please stop saying earliest man. And I said what I just said. It was a very short piece. It was just sort of someone who wants a little logic. Well, lo and behold, it stopped. People stopped saying, and right after that little piece was written, people stopped saying earliest man found. And they said, they would say, a fossil earlier than others has been found, and people wouldn't scurry around building new theories of history and evolution and human behavior around whatever somebody had dug up last. Once again, it sounds strange that an article like that would have to be written, or that people would act that way, but people do tend to build whole worlds on whatever people have found out last. That is why I call this discussion the thread of history. Whenever somebody has a theory of history, well, let me put it this way, the latest ideas about how history developed immediately get whole theories of history and economics and everything else in cosmology based on them. Some scientists will then come along with a theory basing everything on whatever this latest discovery was. And of course, in a couple of years, another discovery comes along, blows that out of the water. But the theory hangs around. Karl Marx is a good example of this. When he wrote in the mid-19th century, it was assumed that the pyramids had been built by slaves. It was assumed that all civilization had come from the Middle East. And his theory of history was sort of based on a history that goes back to the pharaohs, or rather the 19th century idea of the pharaohs, the upper class ruling more and more of slave population under them. And of course, Marx said that people were going to get poor, workers were going to get poorer and poorer and poorer, and there was going to be this revolution and so forth and so on, and none of it worked out because he simply wasn't living in the real world. Marxism is still around, God knows. Ask the people who get shot at trying to get out of communist countries. But the whole Marxist theory is based on nonsense. It's based on outdated history. Historians are always saying that Galileo invented the telescope. He did no such thing. Galileo got the telescope from a publication by a Dutchman, and he did what several hundred other people did. He just improved on it, ground the glass, stuck the right kinds of lenses in each end of a tube, and took a look at the sky. And what he saw contradicted the Bible. And as many people said at the time, how can a man with a tube with two pieces of glass in it contradict the weight and authority of the Bible? Well, it turns out that's exactly what happened. The idea that our world is the center of the universe and the universe rotates around it was not just the Bible, but everybody else's idea of the universe. It's where astrology, which was considered a science back then, came from, because the heavens were perfect. They were put up there for us to look at. And I'm certainly not talking about Christian. I'm talking about pretty well every religion at the time. The stars and all those things were put up there, and astrology just said they were put up there by an intelligence, and therefore they were put up there to guide our actions. Made sense. If you didn't have a tube that had a piece of glass in each end of it, made all the sense in the world. We still have astrology now. What's your sign? But today, it is kind of fascinating if you think the way that people in the old days thought. That is to say, they didn't think in terms of the universe. They thought in terms of the earth and the planets and the stars, and they really didn't live in the same world we live in. Their whole basic way of thinking was different. When you consider yourself on a planet because of gravity, and the universe means an entirely different thing to us when we look at the stars than it did in the early days. By the way, in the old ancient days, they used to refer to Mars as Aries. And Mars are both names for the gods of war because it was red. The red planet. This is kind of funny because if you look at it from the United States, it looks like any other planet or star up there. If you look at it from Africa or way out west, or in some places where you don't have the cover of pollution that we have, it actually is pink. I remember one time looking up and seeing this pink thing up there in the heaven, and sure enough, that was Mars. I was in Africa or South America, and it was an angry red planet, and therefore it was called Mars. It was called Red Anger War. So that was a different universe altogether. The world we live in is a different universe from the one Karl Marx lived in. So when I see someone building a huge theory of history on top of the present state of discovery, it always puts me in mind of someone running a Sherman tank across a thread, the thread of history, this poor, thin little thread that's going to be snapped pretty soon, and he's trying to run a tank across it. The fact is, we will never understand history as long as we keep building history on the basis of what we know right now. Rousseau built a whole theory of history that our environmentalists and so forth still live by, that said that uncivilized people living in places like the frozen north or Tierra del Fuego, which is miserably cold down near Antarctica, he pointed out that people like that tend to be peaceful, nice, unaggressive. Well, the problem with his theory is that he then came along and said, well, it's civilization that corrupts people. They're originally, when they're in those places, they're peaceful and nice and stuff, and civilization corrupts them. As a matter of fact, the people he was pointing to, like the Eskimos or the Inuits, were not always that peaceful. In fact, when Greenland got cut off from Europe because of the ice storm, the ice age, around the 14th century, the peaceful, peace-loving, non-aggressive Eskimos invaded and took over the place. The Hottentots in the Namibian desert, the Kalahari Desert, are known as being very, very peaceful, unaggressive, oh man, just charms. They weren't always that way. What happened to them was they got driven back in there because they weren't as aggressive as another race, which is what we call black today. But the black people that we call the black race today were from the upper end of sub-Saharan Africa. The ancestors of the Hottentots lived as far north as Nigeria, but the more aggressive blacks drove them out. So you have the Capeoid race, because we found them surviving in the Cape area in the Kalahari Desert, the ancestors of the Hottentots and their cousins. And then you have the Congoid race, the black race that later became the Zulus and the Belis and the Manicas and all the other groups that used to live much further north up in the Congo and beyond in Africa. They were the ones who took that area away from the Capeoid race. It's kind of interesting when people are always talking about how the white man took Africa from the black man, that actually the white men were there in southern Africa before the present black population was. In fact, the only reason the Hottentots survived at all, and the Coloureds, who became part of the Cape Coloureds down in Cape Town, the reason that race survived at all, that earlier race, is because the Afrikaners, as they moved forward in the Great Trek, ran head-on into the Zulus, into blacks who had been driving these people, these Hottentots and their cousins, out of Africa. In fact, today what we call Zimbabwe was inhabited just 500 or so years ago by the ancestors of today's Hottentots. They were driven off their land. And it's hard to say how much land they were driven off of, but it's in the millions of square miles. So today's black people are actually the descendants of aggressors who took the land away from another race. And the Afrikaner, the white race, is the only race we know of that actually saved another race. There wouldn't be any Hottentots if the Afrikaners hadn't run into the Zulus and fought them, and the Hottentots were able to survive behind the lines of the Afrikaners. This makes a certain amount of difference in history, because I just referred to a place I used to live, which was called Rhodesia, as Zimbabwe. And it's called that because there's a great big ancient fortress, actually it was a gold mine, but it is near Salisbury, Rhodesia, or what is now Harare. And it was very famous. They're still trying to find out who exactly built the thing. But the blacks claim that Zimbabwe was built by them. Now, it may have been built by the Chinese, by the Indians, by Europeans. Some people say it was the land of Punt in the Bible, where the gold came from. The one group that was definitely not there over 500 years ago, when this thing was built about 2,000 or 3,000 years ago, the one group that definitely wasn't there was were the ancestors of today's black people. The place was actually inhabited by Hottentots, or what we now call Hottentots. So this makes a big difference in history, because the whole country is named after something which the black people claim there, the black people who populate now claim their ancestors built. But the one thing for sure is their ancestors didn't build it, if you know your history. So here we have a misnamed country and an entire history that says that the white man took South Africa away from black people, none of which has any relationship to the truth. And we regularly build theories on our concept of history, as Karl Marx did, that are really disastrous. We lost 100 million people at least to communism in the last century. And today, we're still building theories that have practical evil consequences on whatever the latest kick in history may have been. I remember when the average person in Japan was very, very short. I think the average height was about 5'5" for a man in Japan during World War II. They were known for being tiny. Now, the average Japanese is about the same height as the average American. Now, if you built your theory of history on that trend, you would say that by the year 2100, the average Japanese will be about 7 feet tall. Now, before you laugh at that idea, let me explain to you that the Social Security crisis we're facing right now is largely the result of exactly the kind of thinking that would make 22nd century Japanese 7 feet tall. Everybody listening to this program has either seen or heard of a movie Charlton Heston made called Soylent Green. It showed a world that was packed, overcrowded with people. And it began the movie by showing huge families and how the world became overpopulated. And this was the standard of academic thinking at the time. Well, let me explain this to you. During the Depression, very few people got married, for obvious reasons. There were very few children. Then, with the boom in World War II, and the soldiers coming home and setting up families, and the people who had delayed their marriages because of the Depression, they all began having children. There was a baby boom, a generation we now refer to as the baby boomers. So, the historians and the social scientists and the media got hold of that, and they projected that if the population kept increasing at this incredible, alarming rate, that the world would be packed. Americans would be standing on each other's shoulders in poverty the way they were in Soylent Green, which was dated about 2020 A.D. Now, at the same time, the Japanese were shooting upward in height, and anybody who had said the Japanese going to be 7 feet tall would have been laughed at. But in the 1970s, there was a huge program for Europeans and Americans for not to have children. So like today's program against SUVs, if people didn't have children, then the Soylent Green thing wouldn't happen. And so there was a huge campaign against having children, and the boomer generation had very few of them. In fact, in the 1980s, there was one New England college for women that had a 10th year reunion, and they set up a nursery to take care of the children. Being good, fashionable opinion people, not one person in the entire class, not one single woman had a single child. And this is part of the reason that we are becoming a population of older people, and there are very few children. In the 1970s, that was the SUV, that was the thing. The women's libbers had a motto that it is important, a woman who, well, let's see how it went. It is as important for a woman to paint a painting as to have a child. Actually, that's always more important because it's an art to painting that painting, you see, and a child is what any peasant could do. So the population bust got underway, and it was based on Soylent Green thinking. I'm so happy they made that movie, because usually when I tell people about the way people used to think, when I tell people in the 1990s, the media were universally reporting that every time a person defended his home with his gun, there were 43 instances exactly of the brave criminal grabbing that gun out of his hand and shooting him with it. Now, that got cut to pieces in a few years, and police officers were talking about how absurd it was, and it was laughed out of existence, and everybody forgot they ever said that. Certainly the media and the respectable conservatives are experts at forgetting anything dumb liberals say. So, when I point out that that was exactly what all the media were saying just 10 years ago, people look at me like I had a tulip growing out of my nose. When I started this program, by pointing out that magazines and even scientific documents would say that every time an earlier man was found, they would say, the first man has been discovered at. And again, when I repeat that, people look at me like I got that tulip growing out of my nose. Well, if it weren't for Soylent Green, I think that if people understood if people heard what a campaign was going on against children, having children in the 1970s, based on the kind of thinking that would have Japanese growing to 7 feet tall, I would grow that tulip in my nose again. No, sir, this is the kind of thinking people actually build their whole worldview on. And as I say, a large part of our present Social Security crisis tracks right back to that crazy idea on population that was accepted by absolutely everybody in academia at the time. So there is nothing theoretical about the fact that history changes every day. And somehow, we have to accommodate ourselves to the fact that the history we think we base our thinking on is really like ground in an earthquake. Albert Einstein, who was supposed to be one of the great scientific progressive thinkers of all time, actually lived his last years as a scientific reactionary. Einstein spent his last years fighting Heisenberg's uncertainty theorem. He insisted that God does not play dice with the universe, and he fought the quantum theory that we now accept because it went beyond his special theory of relativity. He did not invent the theory of relativity. He adapted it to a universe in which light speed was the maximum. But he wanted science to stop there. He did not want for the world to go on to Heisenberg's quantum theory, which took mankind into a new level of explaining the universe. Einstein also died a political reactionary, in that he was a big fan of Joseph Stalin. He was a socialist, as he called it. It's always amazed me that it took the communists so long to get the atomic bomb. Klaus Fuchs, one of the people in the middle of the Manhattan Project, was an open communist. Einstein was a very open admirer of Stalin. And Robert Oppenheimer, was surrounded by communists. And it was only the incompetence of the KGB, which I have witnessed. They are as incompetent as the CIA, and the CIA is a bunch of Keystone cops. That's why it took Russia 2 or 3 years after having their own people in the middle of the Manhattan Project to actually get the atomic bomb. Einstein was very much a socialist, and of course, socialism is silly. At the time, it was considered the absolute, that is, in the early 50s, it was considered the future, inevitable future. It was considered efficient and all that. And now it's considered rather naive, the idea that a bunch of bureaucrats can run an entire economy from the center. It's a silly system, and you only have to take a look at Russia now to see what that led to. But at the time, it was thought that the Soviet Union was advancing rapidly and standard of living of Russians was going to be higher than Americans and all that sort of thing because of the inevitable future they had at the time, which thinking was firmly based on Karl Marx's mid-19th century view of history and the future. The problem with thinking that you know the future is a very practical one because you go from building a huge theory, riding that Panzer tank across, that Sherman tank across the thread of history, and then the thread of history snaps, and you inevitably go from trying to prove yourself right to trying to suppress any disagreement, which is where Einstein ended up, that's where the communists ended up, that's where the Christian Inquisition ended up. If you think you know the inevitable future, you're not just wrong, you're dangerous. So there should be room for trying to find what solid ground we can and trying to use logic and trying to see the future as it is, changes and all. That's what I try to do here.